racial prejudice. That, of course, was exactly the situation before the court. Loyal citizens were being imprisoned on the prejudicial assumption that their Japanese race made them security risks. Black was trying to think away the truth. "We deem it unjustifiable to call them concentration camps, with all the ugly connotations that term implies," he wrote. Yet Black made no attempt whatever to explain why the camps were not places for the concentration of a disfavored racial minority behind barbed wire. Roosevelt had used the phrase on at least two occasions. In the very moment that Black was insisting that the judge's job was to scrutinize the law for evidence of racial discrimination, he was failing to do what he preached. This liberal activist conception of the role of the judiciary was announced in the decision most frequently criticized for its abdication of the court's duty to protect minorities. It was as if the justices had to form their sense of the obligation to ensure racial justice by engaging in a gross violation of it. Their impulse to deny that they were ratifying racial discrimination is precisely what would later, in Brown v. Board of Education, help them understand their job as blocking such discrimination when its reality could not be avoided. If the overt denial of prejudice is the first clue to understanding the Korematsu decision, the second lies in the majority's embrace of the principle of loyalty. In the opinion, Justice Black took great pains to insist that the court's holding did not authorize the government to detain loyal U.S. citizens once they had been removed from the West Coast. This was a legal fiction. The military order excluding persons of Japanese descent was paired with another order requiring them to turn themselves in for transfer to the internment camps. In practice, that meant that Japanese Americans on the West Coast never had the chance to pack their belongings and move to another part of the country where they might live freely. The combination of the military orders was the reason the Japanese Americans were forced into internment camps. What was before the Supreme Court, in other words, was precisely the question of detention. Yet the same day the court decided the Korematsu case, it also issued its decision in the case of Mitsuya Endo, the stenographer who had been detained at Tule Lake. Endo had gone through the bureaucratic process of applying to leave the relocation center. As part of the process, she had been vetted by the government and found to be loyal. Yet she had not been released, nor had many other detainees who had also been found loyal. Endo's case is today much less famous than Korematsu's, but to the majority, the two were meant to be read in tandem. In her case, the Supreme Court held that Japanese American citizens who had been found loyal must be freed. In practical terms, this meant that the overwhelming majority of people in the internment camps would eventually have to be released. When the Roosevelt administration got wind of the decision, possibly through Frankfurter, who had a former protege working in the War Department under his old mentor, Henry Stimson, it announced its own plans to free those whose loyalty had been ascertained. The timing was no coincidence. The Endo opinion was to be announced on a Monday. In violation of the business norms of the time, the War Department made its announcement the day before, on Sunday, December 17, 1944. Douglas wrote the Endo decision, which he intended as a continuation of his insistence in the curfew case that the government must not detain loyal citizens. His logic dovetailed neatly with Black's insistence in his Korematsu opinion that the exclusion was about loyalty, not race. The original evacuation of Japanese Americans rested, Douglas said, on the fact that it was an espionage and sabotage measure, not that there was community hostility to this group of American citizens. Since loyalty was the basis for the whole program, the president could only have authorized the continued detention of persons still suspected of disloyalty, not loyal Americans. Correctly interpreted, the executive order, military orders, and the laws passed by Congress enforcing them did not allow loyal Americans to be detained. As far as Douglas was concerned at the time, his opinion in Endo's case undid whatever wrong the Korematsu decision might have created. True, Korematsu upheld the original exclusion order and, by implication, legitimized detention of Japanese Americans in internment centers. Yet Douglas expected the real-world effect of his Endo decision would be the release of nearly all Japanese Americans detained. Justice would be done for the internees, and political cover would be provided for the Roosevelt administration's detention policy. As an added benefit, when Japanese Americans returned to the West Coast, it would be because they had been declared loyal. This might conceivably reduce the anti-Japanese sentiment that the administration fully expected the internees would encounter on their return. Indeed, the expectation of such hostility, and its costs to the administration's popularity, was one of the main reasons that the administration had kept the Japanese Americans interned for so long. But Douglas miscalculated in one fundamental and telling way. The principles of legal realism that Douglas had used as a law professor, and that he now sought to apply to his job on the Supreme Court, taught that what mattered was the effect the court's decision had in the real world, not the legal logic used to obtain it. On this view, it did not matter that whereas Black's Korematsu decision had interpreted the Constitution to allow the exclusion, Douglas's Endo opinion relied on the president's order to demand the release of loyal Americans from internment. The difference was technical at best. If this was right, then the detention approved in Korematsu was lawful only if limited to those found disloyal. Ordinarily, legal realism has much to recommend it. Technicalities like the difference between a constitutional decision and one interpreting a presidential order are often less important than the real-world results of legal decisions. But landmark Supreme Court cases are different. Famous decisions take on a life of their own, both symbolically and legally, through the precedents that they set. In these realms of symbol and precedent, Douglas's Endo opinion lacked the all-important heft of the constitutional decision in Korematsu. Interpreting a unique, time-limited presidential order is not the same as interpreting the Constitution. Douglas, true to his realist impulses, did not bother to specify any broad principle that would emerge from his opinion. As a result, his Endo decision, with its emphasis on loyalty and its practical escape hatch for the internees, faded into obscurity. Meanwhile, the Korematsu decision has remained a stain on the reputation of the court and those justices who joined Black's opinion. Over time, Douglas came to see his decision to join Black's opinion in Korematsu as a major error. Already during the war years, Douglas was eager to associate himself with Brandeis, the justice he had succeeded on the court. He visited Brandeis's widow regularly, and it was going round that he is the great successor and follower of Brandeis. For the rest of his life, Douglas would tell listeners that he had been very, very close to Brandeis, and that Brandeis had urged Roosevelt to appoint him to the court. An association with the Korematsu decision was a blow to this liberal image, especially since other justices had dissented so vigorously, while Douglas did not. Years later, after he had learned